Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? Those are the words of Epicurus, a Greek philosopher. He was from Athens, and he lived about 300 years before Christ's birth. And you can see the accusations and questions about God, why he allows evil to exist in the world, and why he doesn't make everything sunshine and rainbows, that these thoughts have been around for a long, long time. And of course, Epicurus wasn't the first to ask them, but what then do we say? It's the second question that he asks that we're going to look at today in a specific light. And here's the question again. Is God able but not willing to prevent evil? See, Epicurus asks the question, and he follows it with an accusation that if God is able to prevent evil, but he doesn't, then he says that God is malevolent, that he is not an all-loving God. Now, this is a huge subject with many, many layers, a lot of facets to it, so we're going to lay down some basic ground rules first that I believe that all of us, because we are gathered here together as a church, we can agree on. Here are the first two sentences of the first fundamental belief of the United Church of God. This is from our booklet, The Fundamental Beliefs. We believe in one God, the Father, eternally existing, who is a spirit, a personal being of supreme intelligence, knowledge, love, justice, power, and authority. He, through Jesus Christ, is the creator of the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. He is the source of life and the one for whom human life exists. So our fundamental belief right at the outset lays out the following, that God has supreme intelligence, knowledge, supreme love, supreme justice, power, and authority. We also see that as the creator, he is both the source of life and the one for whom human life exists. So we see that God, because he is supreme in power, he does indeed have the ability to prevent evil. He has the ability to prevent or to cause to happen anything that he would wish. And because he is also a being of supreme love, then evil exists because it has a purpose. So let's look at the source of evil. Now again, this is from our fundamental beliefs of the United Church of God. We believe that Satan is a spirit being who is the adversary of God and the children of God. Satan has been given dominion over the world for a specific time. Satan has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Satan is ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious angels, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion. So we've set a foundation. God is able to prevent evil, and the source of evil is Satan and his influence through attitudes and deception. But let's go back to Epicurus and his accusation. If God is able to prevent evil but chooses not to, then God is malevolent. That is the question and the accusation. So what does God say to this? Let's go to Isaiah 45. In Isaiah 45, in that chapter, we see the prophecy of God calling out Cyrus by name as a type of Messiah who would perform God's will. And we'll jump in verse 5. Isaiah 45, verse 5, in the King James Version, it reads, I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Verse 7, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now, most of you are reading from the New King James Version. And you'll have noted that in that translation it reads, I make peace and create calamity. That is a more accurate word to use. See, when we look at the word that the King James translates as evil, you'll notice that it is one of those words that in the Hebrew has a very wide range of meaning if you go in and you start studying it. So we need to apply context of both the surrounding verses as well as the general themes of the Bible in order to more accurately understand what that intended meaning is. Now for this verse, Barnes's notes, a Bible commentary, had this helpful comment. It says, the parallelism here shows that this is not to be understood in the sense of all evil, but of that which is the opposite of peace and prosperity. That is, God directs judgments, disappointments, trials, and calamities. He has power to suffer the mad passions of people to rage and to afflict nations with war. He presides over adverse as well as prosperous events. See, in many cases, when people make accusations against God and they start asking the same questions that Epicurus asked, they'll typically have in mind either the big tragedies of humanity, wars, famines, we see refugee crisis, mass destruction due to weather events, or they'll have seen or experienced tragedy on a personal level, a severe illness or an untimely death of a loved one. All of these things happen, and yes, they are terrible. They're terrible to see. They're terrible to experience. It is not fun. But we know that much of it comes through the influence of Satan. But at the end of the day, the responsibility for so much of it lies at the feet of the men and women who make the choice to do evil rather than good. But we see that God does indeed make calamity. As Barnes's commentary said, God directs judgments, disappointments, trials, and calamities. He has the power to suffer the mad passions of people to rage and to afflict nations with war, and he presides over adverse as well as prosperous events. So why would he do such things? Why would God not only allow calamity, but to actually cause it to happen? Well, that's what we'll take a look at now. Let's start by turning to Ecclesiastes. We'll look at Ecclesiastes 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, we're going to pick up in verse 13. It says, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. See, we see in Ecclesiastes a confirmation of what we read in Isaiah 45. Surely God has appointed both the day of prosperity and adversity. God makes peace and calamity. But we also see there in verse 13 a key concept that we need to look at, and that is this. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? Let's turn back a couple of pages in Ecclesiastes to the first chapter now. And let's start reading in verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. We see again the statement that what is crooked cannot be made straight. The things that mankind has made crooked, we certainly can't straighten it out on our own. All we end up doing is making it even more crooked. And we see that what God has made crooked, we certainly can't make that straight. So what are we talking about here with all this talk of crooked and straight and peace and evil, and is God malevolent for allowing evil to exist? We are talking about direction. We are talking about God exercising his sovereign authority, his supreme power, to take events out of the hands of man and to turn them upside down and to change our direction, the path that future events that will take place. And we understand that if we are looking at the big picture, this gives us assurance that God's plan of salvation will indeed be fulfilled. There is nothing that mankind, Satan, or any event that will prevent it from taking place, because God has both the power and the will to take action. But it sometimes takes the form of calamity. So we're going to look at some examples, and we'll find out how God has used calamity and why he's chosen to act in the way that he did. Let's go back to the first place where the path was made crooked. If we go back to Genesis 1, it didn't take long. In Genesis 1, we see the creation of the heavens and the earth, and all that is in it, including mankind. Let's pick up in verse 29. Where God gives instructions to the first humans. Genesis 1, verse 29, and God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food." Verse 30, "Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food." And it was so. Verse 31, then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. It was very good. The path at this point was straight. Now let's skip over to chapter 3, Genesis 3. This is where we see the influence of Satan in his lie to induce the first sin and rebellion against God. And this is where mankind makes the path crooked. Mankind changes direction from obeying God to believing that they could choose their own path for themselves. And we've thought that way ever since. Every single one of us started out that way in our lives. And even when we've been following God in his way for a long time, we can still sometimes feel that pull to choose our own way instead of his. So what did God do? Did he let Adam and Eve just keep going down that path? No. God made them change direction. Let's look at what this change of direction included. Genesis 3, verse 16. Genesis 3, verse 16, to the woman he said, "I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." Then Adam, he said, "Because you heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return." Life was going to be much more difficult from this point forward. See, there are consequences to the decisions that we make, the path that we walk. And mankind was not able to continue on the path that God had originally set them on because they had chosen for themselves another path. But God had, and he still has, a vision for mankind, an ultimate destination for us to strive for, eternal life in the kingdom of God. In the path that Adam and Eve, and the one that every human being ever since has chosen for themselves, will not lead us there. God must change our direction, and he must bend our path toward him and our destiny. Let's skip ahead in Genesis. We're going to see calamity on a monumental scale. Genesis 6. It's your turn there. And most of us have computers now. We'll use them for work. We'll use them for personal use. How many of you have had the experience that you've been working on something for school or for work for a long time, maybe writing a paper, maybe you're putting together an analysis or a presentation for work, maybe it's just an email to a friend, but you've put in a lot of effort, and then the computer locks up. It freezes, and there is absolutely nothing that you can do except to shut it down, restart it, and start it all over again, knowing that all of the work that you had done up to that point has been lost. Anybody have that happen? Control S. That's the instant save. But it's not fun. See, imagine how God must have felt when he had to make the decision that we read about in Genesis 6, verse 5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. God had put in all of the work to create man, to give him the earth to work in and to live in, to multiply, to have families, to experience life and love. And God wanted to have a relationship with man. Everything had started out, as we read, as very good. But now every intent of the thoughts of man was only evil continually. Mankind had locked up. It had frozen up, just like that computer. There was no way that the path that mankind was on at that time, there was no way that it could lead to God. It was a complete and utter dead end, and so God had to reset. He had to hit the reset button on mankind by sending the flood, saving only 8 people to restart human civilization and to set it back on a path that could lead to the kingdom of God. Now, further on in Genesis, we read about Joseph and his rise to power in Egypt. Now, what's fascinating is that God worked through calamity on both a personal and a national scale in order to set the stage for future events. It truly is incredible. Genesis 37 is where we start the beginning of Joseph's story. In Genesis 37, we see that God gets the ball rolling by sending Joseph dreams of greatness, dreams that were not received with enthusiasm by his family. Let's go to verse 23 to see where calamity enters into Joseph's life. Genesis 37, verse 23, so it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. That is definitely a calamity for Joseph. But we know from the story that it was God who took Joseph's path and made it crooked. Later we see that there's another calamity that befalls Joseph. His Egyptian master, to whom he had been sold, makes him the chief servant of the household. But Potiphar's wife attempts to seduce Joseph. And when he refuses, she accuses him of doing what she had hoped he would do. And Joseph has another calamity, being thrown now into prison. Now these personal calamities that Joseph experienced were then followed by calamities on a multinational scale. Let's read about what was coming in Genesis 41. Joseph is pulled out of the prison to interpret Pharaoh's dreams that he had. Genesis 41, we'll start in verse 25. Genesis 41, verse 25, he's pulled out of the prison, he's cleaned up, now he's standing before Pharaoh. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe." And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So a calamity of epic proportions is coming. And Joseph tells Pharaoh in verse 32 that this is established by God, and that God himself would bring it to pass, and that there is nothing that anyone could do to prevent what was coming. And it was through this calamity that Egypt would be set up as a superpower of the ancient world. And Joseph gives solid advice for weathering the coming calamity. Verse 33 says, "Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine." And the famine did come, just as Joseph had interpreted the dream, and calamity befell the entire region. Now let's look at how this calamity set up Egypt as a superpower. Verse 46. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. So because of the foresight of Joseph through God showing him what was to come, Egypt was the only nation in the region that was prepared. Now, let's see the result of this calamity, this crooked spot in the road that God used to redirect the path of history. Breaking into verse 54, it says, the famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all the countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. Now after this, we see the story of how Jacob's sons came to Joseph to buy grain and how he eventually revealed himself to his brothers. We also read about how Israel came to settle in the land of Goshen, in the choicest of all the land of Egypt. But the famine was still going on. Now let's move to Genesis 47. We see some more about how Joseph was dealing with this famine. Genesis 47, verse 13. Genesis 47, verse 13. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. What this indicates for us is that the monetary system has collapsed in the region, because now Pharaoh has all of the money. He's got all the gold, all the silver, anything that was used for money. It's been brought into the treasury of Pharaoh. Because what does it matter? When you're starving, you can't eat money. Grain has become far more important to survival than money. Verse 15. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence, for the money has failed? Then Joseph said, give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Then he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. So now the Egyptians, and you would expect the other nations in the area surrounding Egypt, they are out of money, so now they're going to exchange their livestock. See, after all, you're out of money to buy grain to feed yourself and your family, and livestock, that's just simply more mouths to feed, so you better sell them while you're, you know, while they're still alive. And while you can get something to feed your family. So we read in verse 18, when that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Verse 20, then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. At this point, Egypt became an all-powerful state. All land, and even the people, it all belonged to Pharaoh. But Joseph provided some wisdom to prevent all-out abuse of the people. Verse 20, we read that, then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them, so the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end to the other. Here we go. Copied that in there twice. So anyway, he provided for them. But we see through the calamity that God brought Egypt to the forefront of power in the world at that time. At the same time, what he did was he provided a safe haven for Israel to grow. But he also set Israel on a path that would set the stage for a future calamity. Exodus 1, verse 6. Exodus 1, verse 6. We read, "And Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly. They multiplied and they grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen, in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land.'" So this new Pharaoh is determined to take the children of Israel down a path of slavery and hardship. If we continue reading in Exodus, we see that the hardships were not just physical, but they also had great emotional hardship. I can't imagine living in conditions where your newborn son could be taken away from you and killed. It's very difficult for us to wrap our heads around something like that today. Now, for the sake of time, we're not going to go through all the details of the plagues that God brought on Egypt, but remember the circumstances in which it happened. See, we just saw how God caused the rise of Egypt to superpower status through a calamity that he had ordained to happen, through the famine. See, Egypt had served its purpose then, and now it would serve another purpose. It would be the delivery of Israel and the destruction of Egypt as a superpower. See, it would certainly remain powerful for a long time afterwards, but God made sure that it would not attain its former heights. So let's survey some of the calamities that God brought on Egypt to make sure of it. Exodus 7. In Exodus 7, we have the first plague that was turning the waters of the Nile to blood. Exodus 7, verse 20, "And Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded. So he lifted up the rod and struck the waters that were in the river, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. The fish that were in the river died. The river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river." So here we have a major food source being destroyed. That is a calamity. In Exodus 9, we read of the livestock of Egypt being struck with disease and dying there. So we have another major blow to the food system, both directly through the meat that they would provide, as well as agriculturally, as you use oxen to plow the fields and to tread the grain and to be a source of milk. That's all gone. We also read in the same chapter of the destruction of the fields by hail. And then in Exodus 10, we read about locusts coming and eating whatever was left after the hail. This is a dreadful level of destruction. The major sources of food have all been destroyed. And on top of that, God threw some boils in there so that the people were just simply miserable and they were unable to work. So this is now a nation that is in an economic freefall. And then God brings two more plagues that attack the spirit and the heart: an all-encompassing darkness and the death of the firstborn. And then when you think it couldn't get any worse for the nation of Egypt, Pharaoh decides that he is going to chase after Moses and the Israelites. And both he and his entire army perish in the Red Sea. Now, here in America, we have a hard time picturing what that would mean for us. See, if our president dies while in office, it is a traumatic thing, but there is a balance of power and a chain of command to continue operating as a nation. Ancient Egypt didn't have that. Pharaoh was believed to be a god, and he owned everything in Egypt, and in many ways, Pharaoh was Egypt. And with his death and the destruction of his army, Egypt was left physically and economically devastated, leaderless, and undefended. That is calamity on a grand scale. It was a major turning point in the path of history. See, there are many, many more points in history where we find in the Bible where God used calamities, both personal and national in scope, to turn the direction of events, to change the path. But what does it mean for us? So you know, you're going to have some people who look at all of this, and Epicurus, he would be included in this group. So remember his questions that we quoted at the beginning of the message. See, they would look at the flood and they would say, well, wait a second. You're telling me that God is omnipotent, that he knows everything, and you're telling me that he's all-powerful, that he can do anything, and you're telling me that he's all-loving. Right? So explain to me how all of this fits together with God destroying virtually all of the life on earth through the flood. Explain to me how God could order the wholesale slaughter of entire peoples as we read in Joshua and in other places. How does that fit with love? If God is all-powerful and all-loving, then why didn't he change the situation in some other way? In fact, how can a loving, all-powerful, and omnipotent God be put into such a situation in the first place? Well, the answer is, of course, free will. It's a key for us. Free will. The choices that we and all other human beings make, they determine the path that we are on, both as individuals and as nations. Without the ability to make those choices, we are simply robots programmed to do as God wills. And if that was the case, then God would prevent evil simply by not allowing that choice to exist at all. See, free will, the ability for us to make choices, must include the ability to make the wrong choice. And those wrong choices can and will lead us on a path away from God and from the ultimate destiny that he's determined for all of humanity. The path that you're on right now, at this very moment, is the collection of choices that you have made in your life. Every choice that you have made has had a consequence. Some of them have been major. Some may seem inconsequential. But if you add up enough of them, you'll see that many times it's those little decisions that will end up having just as much or more of an impact on your life. So here's the question. Are you on a path that will lead you to God and his kingdom? See, if you talk to enough people in the church, especially those who have been around for many years, you will hear stories of calamity. You will hear of jobs lost. You'll hear of broken families and other tragedies, those personal calamities. And you'll hear about the scattering of the church. That's a calamity that set in motion the formation of the church organization that we're a part of today. You'll hear these stories, and with some time and some perspective, you'll see that these were turns of the path where a major change was needed, and God used a calamity both to draw attention and to force a decision. And the proof that it works is that these people are here with us today. They went through the calamity, they learned from it, and they made choices to follow God of their own free will. Now, a few months ago, I gave a sermon surrounding the calamities in Joseph's life. It was showing how each of these calamities were opportunities to grow, especially to grow as leaders. Because remember, that is what we're ultimately called to be, leaders in God's kingdom. Now, let's see what Joseph had to say to his brothers about the calamities that we had in his life. Let's go back to Genesis this time in chapter 45. Genesis 45, verse 5, and while turning there, let's be reminded of what we read in Romans 8, 28 from Paul, who certainly had plenty of calamity in his life as well. Romans 8, 28 tells us, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." Genesis 45, verse 5. When Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. Let's back up to verse 3. Genesis 45, verse 3. "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does my father still live?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come near to me.' So they came near. And then he said, 'I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt.'" There may be calamities in our lives, but God gives us peace when we keep in mind that he is in charge. And that whatever we're going through, if we stay on the path of following God, of loving him and his way of life, that just like with Joseph, we will have things work out in ways that we could never have imagined. God does make all things work together for good, even if it first appears as a calamity in our lives. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13. Close today, going back to that wisdom that helps us to put what we've considered today into perspective. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13. "Consider the work of God. For who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, in the day of calamity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other." It is a great source of assurance that God has indeed he's got everything well in hand in the events of the world and in your life as well. So ponder the path of your feet and know that if calamity befalls you, it may very well be God tapping you on the shoulder to get your attention and to force you to make a decision, a change in direction that he intends to put you on a path to lead you to him.